This is day six of this March 2015 7-day session. We'll take one more day now on the teachings of 12th century Chinese Zen master Da Wei, reading from the book Swampland Flowers, translated by Christopher Cleary. This letter is to a Zeng Shu Shi. There has never been anything to give to people, only folks who have been able to point out the road for people. An ancient worthy said, "Having some attainment is the jackal's yelp. Having no attainment is the lion's roar." There's never been anything to give to people. There's nothing that a teacher can give to a student that she or he doesn't already have. There's no wisdom that a teacher needs to impart to a student. It's just folks who've been able to point out the road for others. When he says, having some attainment is the jackal's yelp, having no attainment is the lion's roar, this is the exalted state of one who has gone so far in Zen that she or he has no thought of having attained anything. So, seeing the mind of equality has been opened and confirmed so thoroughly that he or she doesn't feel any sense of having acquired anything, which is the way things are. We can't acquire anything that we don't already have, can't attain anything, because we've always had it. People who have been practicing longer should be very wary of any, be on the lookout for any trace of a thought. It usually comes with pride, a thought of having gotten somewhere. Could be grateful for how practice has opened and how we no longer feel as opposed by our thoughts, at odds with ourselves. But as soon as we let that become a thought of having, being someone special, then that itself is proof that we have a lot further to go. Buddha was someone who had mastered adaptation. In the course of 49 years, in more than 360 assemblies where he taught the Dharma, he guided people according to their individual faculties. Just a comment about these two figures he came up with. In the course of 49 years, he taught for, I think, 45 years after between his enlightenment and his parinirvana. 49 is just one of these conventional Buddhist numbers that it's not meant to be taken literally, 49, but a lot. 49 means a lot. Or even that isn't quite it. It's Roshi Kapil used to say, it's these numbers often in Buddhism are just ways of expressing in finite numbers what can't be really limited to finite numbers. So it's the same with the idea that rebirth usually takes place within 49 days. That's should be taken with a grain of salt. Maybe 49 days, maybe 5 years, Truth is, we don't know. Same with 360 assemblies. That's another one. Yasutani Roshi, in his commentary on Mu and the Three Pillars of Zen, says you must question Mu with all of your 360 bones and 84,000 pores. Your whole being. To us, it can seem like kind of an odd convention to be using these numbers, but there it is. Thus he preached with one voice through all realms, while sentient beings each obtained benefits according to their kind. It's like one gust of the east wind and the myriad grasses all bend down. The Dharma preached by the Buddha is also like this. Here's another letter. He starts again by quoting someone, unidentified. Buddha preached all doctrines to save all minds. I have no mind at all, so what's the use of any doctrines? And then Da Wei comments, basically, there is nothing in any doctrine and no mind in mind. The emptiness of mind and things, both, is their real character. Shunyata. The core, the essence of the Dharma. No thingness. Basically, there is nothing in any doctrine and no mind in mind. The emptiness of mind and things, both, is their real character. But these days, students of the way often fear falling into emptiness. Those holding such views misapprehend expedient means and take the disease for the medicine. They are to be pitied deeply. He's saying, of course, that that emptiness or the realization of emptiness is the medicine. Therefore, Layman Pang said, don't be averse to falling into emptiness. Falling into emptiness isn't bad. He also said, just vow to empty all that exists. Don't make real that which doesn't exist. Just vow to empty all that exists. Of course, it's not for us to empty anything. Everything is empty. Everything, meaning everything is without any fixed substance to it. All phenomena, physical phenomena and non-physical phenomena are devoid of any substance to them, despite the appearance of things. So when he says just vow to empty all that exists, just vow to confirm through your experience that things and no thing are not two. Don't make real that which doesn't exist. And this is the very core of the Dharma. And it can't really be appreciated except through awakening to the formlessness of form. And he says, if you can see through this one saying, then the ignorance born of boundless evil deeds will instantly melt away and disperse. Even the whole great canon taught by the Tathagata cannot explain this one sentence. That's why it takes one's own experience. Can't be grasped except through experience. And yet, probably a lot of people who undertake this practice seriously have some intuition that there is something beyond this world of form, this world of phenomena, something, and that something is beyond thingness, that there is another aspect, another side to the world as we know it. Things are things because of mind, as mind is mind because of things. These two are merely relative, and both at source are emptiness. Before awakening to the formlessness of form, the very word emptiness can cause us to feel uneasy. It's just the nature of the word. But there is nothing that is more of a relief than to realize that things are no thing. It means that things can never impinge on us in the same way again. We can never again feel boxed in. Thoughts can never again have the same threat to us once we've seen that, like everything else, thoughts have no substance to them. And that's a huge advantage in practicing, is to have seen that. Then the thoughts that used to give us so much trouble in the past don't as much. There's still the habit force of seeing thoughts as getting caught in thoughts, seeing them as having some reality to them, but it's less, and it becomes less and less. And to get out from under thoughts, this is huge. And then he continues, Buddhist disciple Chen, you have realized that personal existence is false and that things are illusory. Amidst illusory falsehood, you were able to contemplate the saying, a dog has no Buddha nature. Suddenly, while washing your face, you found your nose and sent me a letter expressing your understanding, trying your hand at explaining Chan. This was like a 3-day-old tiger cub who already has the spirit to devour an ox. The message you conveyed, though, was like a lucky monkey hitting the ground with a stick. Where it hit, it went in a few inches, but where it missed, it had no grasp of the issue at all. So first he commends him for his strong spirit, like a 3-day-old tiger cub who has the spirit to devour an ox. And then he points out that, like almost all first experiences of this, it's pretty faint, and one has so much further to go. He says, though in the main your basis is already correct, you are not yet clear about the great Dharma. This is a common disease of beginners entering the path. If you can realize such a thing, push it to one side and take the essential gate of all the Buddhas and patriarchs and shut it at once. Only if you find a life on the other side of the primordial Buddha will you gain mastery of the Dharma. So don't stop until you come to full enlightenment. If you can realize such a thing, push it to one side. Having no attainment is the lion's roar. And he quotes Yung Chia, another famous Chinese master, realizing emptiness, denying cause and effect, wild and reckless, incurring calamity. This is the all too common mistake of after a little piddling experience of emptiness, blowing it up into the mistake of denying the other side. The law of causation. This is what errant teachers will often rely on to justify bad behavior. Okay, well, after all, it's empty. Oh, everything, morality, right and wrong, causation, it's all empty. Which is true. Half true. Then Da Wei says, just get the root. Don't worry about the branches. Over a long time, it will sink in thoroughly. Work on it. Now, this next one is maybe a talk because it doesn't have the name of a recipient, so it's not a letter, maybe. Good and evil all arise from one's own mind. But tell me, besides your activities, thoughts, and discrimination, what do you call your own mind? Where does your mind come from? If you can discern where your own mind comes from, then boundless karmic obstructions will be cleared away instantly, and all sorts of marvels will come of themselves without being sought. Where do we come from at birth? Where do we go at death? If you know where we come from and where we go, then you can be called a disciple of the Buddha. Who is it who knows of birth and death? And who is it who experiences birth and death? Again, who is it who doesn't know where we come from and where we go? Who is it who suddenly realizes where he comes from and where he goes to? And who is it who, reading these words, blinks his eyes, unable to understand, his belly churning up and down as if a mass of fire were placed in his heart? If you want to know, just apprehend him at the point where he can't understand. If you can recognize him then, you'll know that birth and death surely have nothing to do with him. Just apprehend him at the point where he can't understand. That very incomprehension, that very wondering in that, that not knowing is a place to look directly. He's really in this paragraph outlining the practice of who am I or what am I either. Or for that matter, what is this? What is it? Who doesn't know where we come from and where we go? Whenever you're reading the sutras or the stories of the ancient worthies entering the way, when your mind doesn't understand clearly and it seems bewildering and stifling and flavorless, as if you're gnawing on an iron spike, this is just the time to apply effort. Above all, you must not give up. This is the place where conceptual knowledge doesn't operate, where thought doesn't reach, where discrimination is cut off and the path of reason is annihilated. Where you can always explain reasons and apply discriminations, this all pertains to emotional consciousness. Time and again, people take this thief as their son. Be aware of this. Your mind doesn't understand clearly, and it seems bewildering and stifling and flavorless, as if you're gnawing on an iron spike. That's it, right there. That's just the time to exert yourself. Above all, you must not give up. There is an account here that I've read before, but not in the last 3 years, about an eccentric naturalist by the name of Louis Agassiz. He taught at Harvard in the 1850s, and there's no author here. This is the introduction. Reading up on him years ago, I discovered that he would, when taking on a new grad student or assistant, he would hand the prospective student a pickled, evil-smelling, dead fish, which was personally selected by the master from wide-mouthed jars which lined his shelves. The fish was placed before the student in a tin pan. He was to look at the fish, he was told, whereupon Agassiz would leave, not to return until later in the day, if at all. And what follows here is the account of a Samuel Schutter, who went on to become an entomologist. This is one of Agassiz's students. In 10 minutes, I had seen all that could be seen in that fish. Half an hour passed. An hour. Another hour. The fish began to look loathsome. I turned it over and around, looked it in the face. Ghastly. From behind, beneath, above, sideways, at three-quarter view. Just as ghastly. I was in despair. I could not use a magnifying glass. Instruments of all kinds were prohibited. My two hands, my two eyes, and that fish. It seems a most limited field. I pushed my finger down its throat to feel how sharp the teeth were. I began to count the scales in the different rows until I was convinced that that was nonsense. At last a happy thought struck me. I would draw the fish. And now with surprise I began to discover new features in the creature. When Agassiz returned and listened to Scudder recount what he observed, his only comment was that the young man must look again. And now back to Scudder. I was mortified. Still more of that wretched fish. But now I set myself to the task with a will and discovered one new thing after another. The afternoon passed quickly, and toward its close, the professor inquired, "Do you see it yet?" "No," I replied, "I am certain I do not, but I see how little I saw before." The day following, having thought of that fish most of the night, someone give this man a koan. Scudder had a breakthrough. "The fish," he announced to Agassiz, "has symmetrical sides with paired organs." Of course," Agassiz said, obviously pleased. Scudder asked, "What do I do next?" Agassiz replied, "Oh, look at your fish." The lesson lasted 3 days and nights. "Look, look, look," Scudder later. The lesson lasted 3 days and nights. "Look, look, look." Scudder later termed this experience a legacy the professor has left to me, as he has left to many others, of inestimable value, which we could not buy, with which we cannot part. Zazen, and especially Sesshin, is just that, the training in looking deeply in order to see through. And then having seen through, to look still more deeply. And persisting. Leaving aside any notion of some final crowning experience or realization, the looking itself is what has the great value of character development. Development of our faculties, our potential, our capacities to go beyond ourselves, to see further and further. Now, this is a letter. "You've indicated you want me to instruct you by letter in the direct essentials. This very thought of seeking instruction in the direct essentials has already stuck your head into a bowl of glue. His point, of course, is that no one can instruct another in the essentials, the true essentials. That can only be grasped oneself. So long as we are concerned about instructions or techniques especially, then we're on the periphery. We haven't got to the marrow of the thing. He says, "Though I shouldn't add another layer of frost to the snow, nevertheless, where there's a question, it shouldn't go unanswered. I ask," and then he proceeds to give instructions, "I ask you to abandon at once all the joy you've ever felt in reading the words of the sutras yourself or when being aroused and instructed by others. Be totally without knowledge and understanding, as before, like a 3-year-old child. Though the innate consciousness is there, it doesn't operate. Then contemplate what's there before the thought of seeking the direct essentials arises. Observe and observe. So look to see what is there before the thought of seeking the direct essentials has even arisen. And look and look. As you feel you're losing your grip more and more and your heart is more and more uneasy, don't give up and slack off. This is the place to cut off the heads of the thousand sages. Students of the way often retreat at this point. If your faith is thoroughgoing, just keep sitting. What precedes the thought of seeking instruction and the direct essentials? Suddenly you will awaken from your dream and there won't be any mistake about it. Now there is a place, of course, in Doksan or elsewhere to ask questions, but sometimes it can actually be a way of avoiding looking at this fish. It's a way of dodging the work of relying on one's own nature. And in that sense, it's a little indicates a lack of faith in one's own resources. Someone seasoned in practice, sesshin practice, comes to see that you just have to. The sooner you learn to rely on your own investigative powers, the better off you'll be. Get some clarity, get some misunderstandings cleared up, but then after a certain point, you've just got to buckle down and bore into the practice and look. There can be a little tinge of wanting the teacher to do it for you. And that just is not how it works. Next letter. Whether you're happy or angry, in quiet or noisy places, you still must bring up Zhao Zhou's Mu. Above all, don't consciously await enlightenment. If you consciously await enlightenment, you're saying, right now I'm deluded. If you wait for enlightenment, clinging to delusion, though you pass through countless eons, you will still not be able to gain enlightenment. As you bring up the saying, that is the koan, just arouse your spirit and see what principle it is. See what the essence of it is. This is a devilish obstruction to awakening, is the expectation or the waiting, the hope, the anticipation of a breakthrough. It's devilish because often it's so subtle that one's not aware of it. This expectation or hoping, this looking up at the top of the mountain can go on for years before one finally, through ongoing practice, finally sees that habit force, that looking elsewhere, waiting, expecting, hoping, anticipating. And then upon seeing it, then one has a real chance of shaking it off, and it no longer becomes an obstruction. But this is where mindfulness is so vital to notice these subtle, these traces of conceptualization, like expecting, waiting, hoping. Whether eating or drinking, whether in quiet or noisy places, you should make scrupulous efforts from moment to moment. Always as if you owed someone millions with no way out, your heart sorely troubled with no opening to escape. When your awareness has gotten like this, this is precisely the time to apply effort. Concentrate on the koan right here. See how these masters would see, they would see the value in feeling the burden of not knowing, and the value of feeling responsible for finding out, that this pressure can be one's greatest ally, sense of pressure. Sense of owing it to, above all, oneself, to become what one can fully, to become what one is already, to live up to one's nature. He repeats, a monk asked Zhao Zhou, "Does a dog have Buddha or nature or not?" Zhao Zhou said, "Mu." As you work on this, don't try to figure it out. Don't try to explain it. Don't demand clear understanding. Don't take it verbally. Don't construe the raising of it as the principle. Don't fall into empty quiescence. Don't consciously anticipate enlightenment. Don't take your understanding from the explanations of the teachers of our school, and don't drop it into the bag of unconcern. This seems to have been, it's mentioned enough in the texts, the old texts, that it must have been a somewhat common trap for the monks of that time. And it had happens now here too in our own era, where you can find yourself in this weird state of mind where you become indifferent, where you become whatever, you know. That the form it sometimes takes is, okay, well, moo is moo. All right. Don't drop it into the bag of unconcern. Whether walking, standing, sitting, or lying down, just constantly call the koan to mind. What is mu? When you can keep your attention on it fully, when verbal discussion and intellectual consideration cannot reach and your heart is agitated, when it's like gnawing on an iron spike without any flavor, then you must not falter in your intent. When you get like this, it's good news. It's good news. Where else in life do we encounter this understanding that when your heart is agitated, that's good news? Then you've got something that's really happening, really working there. If one is completely comfortable and relaxed, then what's going to happen from there? It has to be this involvement, this need to know. Time is up. We'll stop now and recite the four vows.